I'm so glad you're here with us on the Clark Howard Show, where it's about you being empowered with knowledge so you can save more and spend less, and don't let anyone ever rip you off. Coming up in a few minutes in today's Clarkrageous Moment, do you know there's something you could do with your cell phone that could cost you your life? I'm going to fill you in, tell you how to protect yourself. And coming up yet later, if you apply for a job with a big company, do you know the first cut usually isn't going to involve humans? I'm going to tell you how to beat the robots. Right now, though, I'm going to give an update on something I talked about before called Petal. P-E-T-A-L. Petal is one of the new wave of companies that is trying to come up with a way to issue credit cards to people who don't have a credit history. You know, I'm asked all through the years, what do? I don't have any credit right now. How do I get started? And I talk about going to credit unions. I talk about secured cards and what are the options for you to establish credit? Well, Petal, and it's Petal Card, P-E-T-A-L card.com, is taking applications now. And what they do is they use a different algorithm to decide if you're credit worthy than a traditional one. What they do is they look at how you, what you do for a living and what bills that you have already and what kind of track record you've had paying those bills that are not necessarily anything to do with lending or loans. So with them, you open up an account, you apply for the card, and then as long as you are, in fact, paying them as agreed, you are now being reported to the credit bureau. There's no fees to have the account. The interest rates on the card are relatively high, 15 to 25%. The credit limits start very low at $500, go as high as $10,000. But it gives you a chance to avoid the normal processes of getting a card. And as long as you behave yourself with the card, you fast track to establishing a good, solid credit record. And so there are going to be more and more efforts to try to find the diamonds and not the rough, the diamonds that no one can find, because everything historically has all been based on one thing, a credit score that tens and tens of millions of Americans don't have. They have thin files or no files. And Petal Card is an alternative. Is it going to be great? Are they going to do a great job? I can't answer that. All I can tell you is that they're offering a new way for you to go from no credit to having credit and being given a chance to prove yourself. Tyler's with us on the Clark Howard Show. Hello, Tyler. How are you?
I'm doing fine, Clark.
Tyler, how can I be of service?
Well, Clark, I'm not the wisest person when it comes to computer technology, nor am I with consumer math. But I'm in a situation where I need to get an insulin pump. My pancreas stopped working, so friends and coworkers had told me, well, try the GoFundMe thing. Well, I happened to be on the Facebook communicating with these people when this took place, and I seen, well, Facebook's got one. So I set up an account, and immediately people I know started contributing on there. And then I was like, well, I need to see how I'm supposed to get the money. Well, when I did that, then it asked me for my bank routing address and everything. And I'm like, oh, I feel very uncomfortable with this situation, especially with all the hacking that has taken place with Facebook and most recently as well.
No, that's so the right thing to do. With the bigger player GoFundMe and the smaller imitator, the Facebook funding option, give your checking account so they have the place to put your money into.
Right. And I did the GoFundMe as well. I set up one. I haven't actually given either one of them my banking information. Of course, I was waiting to consult with you, as I have been following you for years, and I appreciate your advice.
Absolutely. So first things first, I hope that you get the insulin pump as quickly as possible. And second, with both of them, go ahead and give them your checking account information, because that's how you're going to get the money. The way it works is you'll get the money minus their credit card merchant processing fees that they'll charge you.
Right.
So what happened was GoFundMe used to, their business used to be based on charging a percent to people for having the GoFundMe page plus the credit card merchant processing fees. Now they've eliminated the money that they were getting in fundraising campaigns, and all they do is charge you for their costs with the credit card companies, and that's exactly what Facebook is doing also.
So, yeah, it looked very similar there. When I looked into the details of the information, it did look very compatible in what they were doing. More people, like you say, with the Giant, I felt a lot more comfortable with the Giant of GoFundMe. There's just so many people are using that successfully, but I could not get any feedback at the time from Facebook's fundraiser program. I had not known anybody that had used it.
I've never, and you're the first person I've ever heard of who's used it.
And I talked to my the manager at the credit union I use, and I use credit unions again due to your advice several years back, as opposed to banks. But yeah, that's, I talked to her. She said, "I'd never link anything to my account," but that's just me. And I'm like, "Well, you probably make a little bit more money than I do as
well." That is generally good advice, and the fact that you're being skeptical is the right thing, because you don't want to willy-nilly ever hand out your checking account number, your bank routing and checking account number to anybody. But in this case, you gotta. And I hope that your campaign is solid and successful, and you get the medical gear that you need to keep you healthy. Jim joins us on the Clark Howard Show. Hello, Jim.
Hi, Clark. Thanks for taking my call.
Absolutely. Jim, how can I serve you?
Well, I'm a few years from retirement. I work for a non-charity or a nonprofit, and I have a 403B and a traditional IRA and a couple of other sources of income that will be available when I'm retired. But I keep getting emails from an organization that is pushing something called an infinite banking concept, and I can't find out anything about it except that it looks like it's tied to a dividend paying whole life insurance.
Yep, you got it. And
I know
this
you don't promote that for, or you don't recommend that for insurance, and I just didn't know if it was a viable thing for retirement income.
No, I don't like this at all, and it's something that has been pitched so many different ways in recent years. I've had a lot of calls recently that people have referred to it as a 702J plan and things like that, where the people pitching this stuff make it sound like it's magical, that it's like a loophole in the tax code or whatever. And life insurance does have, in certain circumstances, some tax advantage to it. But the problem with using whole life insurance as a vehicle to fund some amount of retirement is that the expenses and commissions involved with the whole life insurance policy are so gigantic that the efficiency of your money is not very good. There's such a focus on, if you do this, you're going to avoid tax. That's the whole big pitch. But one thing you mentioned, you said you're doing a regular IRA. Do you know what's so superior to this strategy that's being pitched around whole life insurance? And anytime somebody calls me and asks me about using whole life insurance as a way to pay for retirement, and I'll ask, well, are you fully funding a Roth IRA? Mm-hmm. Because a Roth IRA beats any life insurance policy 365 days this year, because there's only 365. It's not a leap year. If it was leap year, it would be at 366 days. So you're doing good strategies. The only modification I would make is instead of contributing to a regular IRA anymore, I would instead contribute to a Roth IRA.
Well, if I only have like 2 years or so to retirement, is that going to pay off?
Well, I don't know how much money you would put into a whole life insurance policy. But,
well, I'm not going to do that at all.
Okay. But if you were considering it and you were thinking of doing that, whatever money you would have potentially put into that, put that instead into a Roth. You can put aside up to your past age 50. So you can put in up to $6,500 max, but you can put in whatever you can afford into a Roth. And the fact that you're approaching retirement doesn't take away from the advantage of a Roth, because where a Roth is so great is its flexibility. You put money in it, you retire, you're not working anymore. But the money in there can continue to grow tax-free for years and years and years to come, till maybe much later in retirement when you need it, and then you spend it tax-free.
I see.
So that's why the Roths are
Would you recommend that I put my I'm putting $6,500 a year in the traditional. Would you recommend that I stop that? If I can't do both, stop that and put it in the Roth?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly, because you already are doing the 403B plan. You're already doing a lot of pre-tax stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I want you to have some post-tax money that will not be taxed later. And that's why doing the Roth IRA, in my mind, would be a preferable option to doing the traditional IRA. But anybody's pitches about how the magic of whole life insurance is going to create this tremendous wealth for you, and you're going to cheat the government because you're never going to have to pay them any tax because you're going to be able to pull all this money out tax-free. Yuck, yuck, yuck. I hate it.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Today's Clarkrageous moment is really a key warning for you. It is a crazy, tragic way to die. Believe it or not, people are dying in appreciable numbers by taking selfies. How could taking your cell phone out and taking a selfie cost your life? Well, according to researchers from a medical group, people are doing it because they get distracted. One of the most common ways, and this is something that I actually talked about on the show when this happened, when a couple died because they got swept away by waves when they were taking selfies. And this happens in a lot of beautiful coastal kind of areas with cliffs. People will stumble. They'll fall off trying to take a selfie. They will walk right into a car or whatever and die that way. Selfies, fortunately, almost always are just a fun thing to do and completely safe. But be completely situation aware, as we say, people say in the military. But be aware of your surroundings. And if you are at a beautiful scenic vista, please be very, very, very wary of getting into a position where you could cause yourself danger. I remember when we were last in Maui, which was 3 years ago, and there's a place at the northwest tip of Maui where there's these beautiful lava rock formations, and there was a couple out on one of them taking pictures with their cell phones while waves were crashing. And my wife and I were so upset because they didn't realize how easily they could have been swept out to sea. And you don't want the last thing that happens is to be in such a magnificent place, having such a great time, and by not sensing the danger, well, being swept away. So, not trying to kill your fun, just trying to keep you from getting killed. So, Joel, I think we can sneak in and ask Clark here.
All right, Clark. Bill wrote in, he said, where do I find good, affordable hearing aids without mortgaging my home?
Yeah. The good news is that hearing aids are getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper after years of having, in the United States, by far the world's highest prices. There are changes in the law and regulation that gradually are bringing the prices down. The most aggressively priced FDA-approved hearing aid is from iHearMedical.com, I-H-E-A-R, medical.com. The hearing aids are $499, and that is a very aggressive price in the marketplace. Both Sam's Club and Costco Wholesale have dropped the prices on some of their hearing aids by a significant amount of money. Kirkland Signature hearing aids are $15.99 a pair now. And I forget what the Sam's Club price is. It's something in that general range. So the era of the $6,000 a pair hearing aid is not over, but you don't have to pay that kind of money anymore. And we will eventually get to worldwide prices. World prices for hearing aids, if you're not aware, are generally in the range of a few hundred dollars an ear. We are the exception in the world with these massive prices, and it's because we've had a very inefficient distribution process in the United States that is coming to an end. It's my pleasure to welcome you to the Clark Howard Show, where it's about you learning ways to save more and spend less, and don't let anyone ever rip you off. You think somebody's about to rip you off, you got a question, you got a problem, we're here to help. And we do so off the air as well, over 40 hours each week. You can talk with a member of Team Clark for nothing. We've been doing this for 26 years, answering your questions off the air. If you scroll down a little at clark.com, you'll see the phone number and hours available for free off-the-air advice. I want to talk about something that I had so many questions about during the Great Recession. Don't get as many questions about resumes as I used to. And there's such a change in how particularly larger companies treat a resume compared to how they were treated in the past. Also, job applications that are filed electronically, how they're treated by employers. Okay, so this is weird, weird, weird. Bigger companies that either accept electronic applications, written ones, or resumes, have them scanned by software almost exclusively on at least the first round, never reviewed by a human. Because big companies that people know of and are aware of get zillions of applications, and they don't want to spend the time or the labor looking through them. So they have them scanned for keywords based generally on the skill set of the job they're hiring for. And so, and you can find lots of this information online about how the keywords should be positioned, but you want to make sure you're using industry terminology if it relates to the job that you're applying for. If you're doing something in the IT field or tech, whatever certification initials you have, whatever skills you have, whatever training you've had, that's got to be prominently and clearly written on an electronic application, a written one, or a resume to be picked up by the scan to get through the first cut. But here's a dirty little secret you need to know, particularly with larger employers. The fix is in. Most jobs are what's called wired. The applicant they intend to hire for that job is already known before the job is posted. You are given false hope, in most cases, that they're actually interested in you, even if you make it through the electronic cuts, maybe a human review, somebody calls you for a phone interview or calls you in for an in-person interview, and you think, wow, this is great. I'm on my way to working here. And all along, they're playing you because they're just trying to meet the requirements that HR has laid out for them at these big companies, that they show that they've had a diversity of applicants before they made their final hiring decision, who's the person they intended to hire before the job was ever posted anyway. The key thing for you when you're looking for a job or a new opportunity, people hire people. Forget the machines. It is the rare exception that somebody makes it through that clutter to get a job when it was not a situation already wired. You need to be the one that the job's wired for. And the most important thing when you're looking for work, ignore the giant employers. They are slow growth entities, many times actually reducing headcount over time. The larger a company gets, the less dynamic it becomes. And the real growth in jobs, the real opportunity, comes with smaller, generally, potentially faster growing firms that nobody's ever heard of. That's where you find the opportunity. Don't go to the big brand name company everybody's ever heard of. Go look for opportunity with companies no one has ever heard the name of ever. Generally, companies, businesses that sell to other businesses, not to consumers, are where the greatest opportunity lies, not only for employment, but for advancement as well. Daniel's with us on the Clark Howard Show. Hi, Daniel.
Hey, Clark. How's it going?
Wonderful, Daniel. So, Daniel, you are thinking of buying a home, and you live in the state of?
Beautiful Colorado.
Where the housing market has been brutal for people who are trying to buy a home and beautiful for people who already own one.
Exactly.
Where do you fit in all this?
It's beautiful living here, but I'm definitely, as far as trying to get a first, you know, become a first-time home buyer, it doesn't seem very accessible.
That's a beautiful understatement. Are you in the Denver metro area, or where are you?
Yeah, exactly. I'm just right outside Denver.
So in Denver, it's become impossible for someone in a middle-class job to buy a home right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the way it is. And it's been very frustrating to people. I read a story in the last few days, I think it was in the Financial Times, that did a story about how there are people in middle-class professions in Denver that are actually choosing to move somewhere else in the country because they don't see any prospect they'll ever be able to own a home in Denver at the kind of salaries they make in a middle-class kind of job. It's tough.
Yeah, I really don't know how people do it. It's, you know, my wife and I, as a household, we make well above the median income. So I can only imagine for those people who make below the median income, you know, what they're facing.
Well, one of the issues in Denver, which is not just a Denver problem, it is in other areas as well, is the cost of land acquisition for builders, and then the cost of permits, the cost of hiring labor, and the cost of material. New homes are out of sight. And builders, because of the base cost they have for land and other things like that, they only want to build larger, more expensive homes to try to make any profit out of the deal. So you really have to, you and your wife really have to concentrate if you want to go ahead and buy now on used homes. But housing markets go in cycles. And anybody who's been in Colorado or Utah for a long time knows the swings that have occurred in both states, with real estate going on a pendulum of extremely high demand followed by a wave of soft demand. Do you think you and your wife have a little patience in you, or do you want to go ahead and pull the trigger now on getting something?
Well, I definitely have patience. You know, I'm looking more at the long term, and that's kind of what related to what my question was, is what I've been curious about is, you know, for folks who buy during when it's, you know, the market's really hot, are they worse off than people who buy in a buyer's market, you know, just long term? Because, you know, for our second home, no matter when we go to the second home, you know, housing values are going to be up or down. But if we jump in when things are very hot, I would just wonder if long term that would impact our finances in a negative way.
So the way you make that test is by comparing the cost of renting today versus what your effective cost of home ownership would be today. If when you take the cost of the mortgage, taxes and insurance, and add those together, if they are more than 20% higher than what you can rent today, you're best off waiting a while before you buy.
Mm-hmm.
If you can buy a place at a margin that is less than 20% higher for current cost of mortgage, taxes, and insurance versus rent, then particularly if you're going to own a property for a significant number of years, which in an overheated market like the Denver metro area, you want to look at a ownership window of 10 years. If you're comfortable in owning a house for 10 years and you can buy it within that price window I'm talking about, no more than 20% higher effective cost per month than rent, then go ahead and buy. Otherwise, I'd wait for a down cycle. And they always come.
Yeah, I think I'm going to wait. I think our focus is going to be just, you know, sticking out in the apartment and, you know, putting as much towards my student loans as possible.
Well, that is a very effective strategy. You know, a lot of people don't feel like they've really settled down if they're renting instead of owning. But that is something that is in some sense, psychological. And if you can get your financial house better in order, and getting rid of student loans is a great thing to do, and rent and let the market find a new equilibrium, I would do just that. James is with us on the Clark Howard Show. Hi, James.
Good afternoon, Clark. Great to speak with you.
Great to have you here, James. You're a little muffled sounding right now, though.
Oh, sorry about that. Is that a little better?
That is better.
Okay, my question for you is, I work for a Fortune 100 company. I've been contributing to a traditional 401k for the past 17 or so years. I currently contribute 11% with a 6% company match. And just this month, they have advised that they're going to start offering the Roth 401k. So I'm kind of halfway into my retirement contributions. I'm going to be contributing for about another 17 years, give or take. I wanted to know if I should switch, which would be more beneficial to me.
I love the idea of you having done a traditional 401k all these years, moving forward doing the Roth 401k, because what it'll give you in retirement and your company match, that 6% the company matches, will still be pre-tax money even if you do the Roth 401k moving forward. But having a pile of money that's pre-tax pile and a pile of money that's after-tax pile, which the Roth becomes, is extremely helpful in retirement to make sure that you harvest money as you need it from what would be the most efficient at that time in that year. Also, we have a really good shot that tax rates are going to be higher in the future than they are now. And that would make it a potentially better idea to do a Roth 401k instead of traditional moving forward. But there is an exception. And let me discuss with you whether you're an exception.
Okay.
If you're making huge money in your job, then you want to do the traditional, because if you're an extremely high income earner, the odds are better that you're in a higher tax bracket working than you'll be in retirement.
What defines high?
I would say if you're a very small percent of people would be in this territory. Are you single or married?
Married.
Do both of you work?
No, just me.
All right. If your income is north of $250,000 a year, then you'd want to do the traditional.
Not quite there. So about half of that.
So, yeah. So if you're at 125 family income, I would do the Roth 401k moving forward. And if you can hang at 11%, because remember, you're going to have to use after-tax dollars instead of before-tax now. If you can keep your contribution at 11, you'll actually effectively be significantly boosting what you're saving for retirement.
Excellent. Sounds great.
So that would be a wonderful strategy. All these years of pre-tax, all the future years, a mix of pre-tax and post-tax, employer pre-tax, your dollars post-tax, that's really good. Robin is with us on the Clark Howard Show. Hi, Robin.
Hi, good afternoon.
How are you?
Oh, doing well, thank you. How about yourself?
Good, good. You want to talk about your mom?
Yes, my mother is 90 years young, and she has decided to sell her home finally. So
wait, she's been living on her own up to 90 years of age?
Till just about 8 months ago, yes.
Wow, very impressive.
Yes, very. So what should she do with the proceeds from the home? She's not going to purchase another home. She's going to continue living with me.
And so the money will be for the purpose of living expenses for her?
Living expenses or a fund in case she does need care in a rehab or hospital or nursing home.
Okay. All right. So... and then ultimately, when your mom does pass away, what are her wishes with these proceeds if they're not needed for medical care or things like that?
To be divided among her four children.
Okay. All right. So I would say that at her age, you've got to just play it as simple as possible because you don't know at what point she might need some medical care, may need to be in assisted living or whatever. And this is going to sound so unbelievably conservative, but I would put the proceeds into a simple savings account.
Really?
Yeah, because
okay.
If you told me that the proceeds from this, she's really not going to need, they're ultimately going to be inherited by her children, then I would recommend something completely different. I would recommend investing the money and letting it grow till the time of her passing, that hopefully is still a long way from now. Maybe she'll break the century mark. And and then you'd be able to, whoever would be the executor would be able to distribute those proceeds. But in a case where you don't know if the money's going to be needed for her care, you can't really invest it.
Okay, correct. That's what I was worried about.
And so that's why the proceeds need to go into simple savings, but not at a traditional bank. It should be at an online bank where right now you can earn about 2.25%.
Okay.
And then the money's available as it's needed. And if it's not needed, then ultimately it would be distributed per her wishes.
Yes.
So nothing exotic here. No room
okay.
for that. And if you go on, I'll give you a couple of sites. You can see the best deals on online savings accounts. Go to bankrate.com. Go to gobankingrates.com. Either of them will get you a list of the best deals around the country for online savings accounts.
Oh, well, perfect. Thank you very much.
Sure. And best of health to her. And you're a great daughter taking in your mom and taking care of her.
Well, we enjoy it.
You're listening to The Clark Howard Show. Thanks for joining us today. The Clark Howard Show is produced by Kim Drobes, Joel Larsgaard, Deborah Reese, and Jim Ayers. And remember, 24 hours a day, we're there to serve you at Clark.com and ClarkDeals.com.